Hey, you want to say something really scary?
Do you believe in the existence of witches?
You're skeptical, my dear.
The boogeyman is real, and you found him.
There is nothing to worry about. You're going to be just fine.
Belief in magic and the occult is part of mental illness.
We all go a little mad sometimes. She just goes a little mad sometimes.
Don't be afraid.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
You believe in God?
I am God.
I want to hear you scream.
That's all there is, as far as witchcraft is concerned.
When someone asks you if you're a god, say yes.
What's up, Hep Cadets, cats, and kittens? It's your host, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See here on another Friday morning in America. Sorry I missed y'all on Wednesday. I'm going to explain why that is in a minute, but before I get too heavy into my stuff, I want to give a shout out to the newest member of the Hep cult, Pyramid. Thank you very much for signing up with us. We appreciate you becoming one of the Hep cadets here at the Hep cult, and anyone else who would like to become a member of the Hep cult, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com/comeandseepod. And there's a few different reward tiers for you there, a few different options for amounts. You can kick ducats the direction of the show so that I can pay for bills and things of that nature, which, you know, we like lights and things. So I'm going to explain what happened on Wednesday. So I've been since I sort of became stationary again in a somewhat rural feels polite. Anyway, there's a pack of wild dogs in this area. There's like a pack of coyotes in the area. In fact, they fucked up a part of my recording session for the Monday episode because they were killing a deer and it was so loud that it was coming through on the recording. So that's been like a constant thing. And like, I have two dogs, as many of you listeners are aware, Otis and Jeff, Beagle and a Jeff. And, Jeff had been limping for a while. He sprained his ankle or something. I think he fell off the bed. And he'd been limping for about a week. So he's already between 10 and 12 years old, not in the best shape physically to begin with. So, understanding that there's nocturnal carnivores in the area, I carry my sidearm whenever I walk the dogs at night, so that if anything happens, whether it's a bear or, I don't know, whatever, then I'm covered in that way, right? So we go to take a walk outside. As soon as we go outside, both dogs start growling. Jeff starts pacing back and forth and barking down into the woods. Otis is planted his feet. I can hear things in the woods moving around back and forth because, of course, there's enough leaf fall now that everything makes noise when it moves. So I'm aware that there's something coming up the hill. And this pack of dogs kind of rushed at my dogs, and one of them went for my boy Jeff, so I shot it. And you know, that's not a thing that as an animal lover you ever really want to have to do, but it's a thing that I had to do. But it gets worse because the coyote didn't die. It ran off into the woods. So at like 1:40 in the morning, I had to track a coyote through the woods to find it, to kill it, because I wounded it. Which is the responsible thing to do if you wound an animal, but it also meant that I was a black person wandering through the woods in a rural area at like 2:00 in the morning with a gun looking for a wounded animal, which isn't a situation you ever really want to find yourself in, I think. So it was awkward, and I was very shaken up. My dogs were very shaken up, and I just felt that I needed to take a day to decompress and not talk about ghosts or whatever. So I was originally going to put out Wednesday's episode on Thursday and do it a day late, but by Thursday afternoon, I was just whooped from emotional and psychological exhaustion, so I decided to, give myself a Wednesday, which is, prudent, actually, because I should give you a heads up. I guess I could do this at the end of the show, but fuck it, we're doing it now. My birthday is this Sunday, so I'll be taking next week off from the show as sort of a, hey, maybe I won't spend 50 hours reading, kind of a thing, as kind of a birthday present to myself. And because I am a shameless whore for self-promotion, if you would like to contribute to my birthday fund, I can be reached on Cash App at #Moxie, M-O-X-Y, O'Brien. O-B-R-I-E-N, traditional Irish spelling. If you'd like to throw some cash my way from a day, that'd be cool. If not, that's cool too. But I'm going to, before we switch back over to like the regularly scheduled programming on the show, I'm going to take a week off where I'm not staring at books for like 13 hours a day, because I think my head needs that. So after today, we'll be off for a week, and then we'll be back to cover some more socio-political and conspiratorial content. We're gonna have some guests in the third period of the season. Period. That works. I don't know why I keep trying to say third half. Period works out fine. Some of you like hockey. So that's the plan schedule-wise for the next couple of weeks. But today, holy fuck, listeners. So we've discussed in the past that I have some picadillos, some predilections, some opinions about some of the things that I cover on this show. Now, I have opinions about everything I cover on this show, or I wouldn't be covering it. But what I'm trying to say is, sometimes I cover shit that I hate because I think it will be interesting for the show. That's what today is. I've as a person who has been accused of being goth in the past, who I think you could consider to be, at the very least, spooky adjacent. I have had people tell me that I look creepy in public before, so I think that counts. As a person who's prone to wearing lots of black and lots of makeup and occasionally a cape, that's sort of a joke. I've never really gravitated toward vampire fiction or vampire lore. It's always just felt very to me and kind of whatever. I don't know. I mentioned the other day I'm more of a zombie person. You know, zombies are a bit more my speed. I also grew up very much liking werewolves, and of course we know about the aliens and the other stuff. But vampires never really did it much for me. I find the whole thing to be cringy and god-awful boring, if I'm being completely honest with you, but I did find out some very interesting things doing research for this episode, but that is a long tail and a kite to say that I'm just really, really, really glad that I'm doing vampires now, and I ostensibly never have to discuss vampires on this show ever the fuck again, as is at least my plan as of right now. Something will happen in the vast cockles of the universe that will require me to talk about vampires now that I have spoken aloud that my intent is to never fucking do that again. But as of right now, this is a one and done. So that being said, we're going to try to do as much of an exhaustive on European vampires as is possible. Like, it's fair to say that there's vampire folklore from fucking everywhere in some form or fashion, if not a specific vampire thing, then something that sucks blood or eats children. Like, they've got that everywhere. We've got that in stock. So, I to narrow it down, as I tend to do, and on season four, I promise I'm going to try not to do this as much with some of the material now that I know that I have listeners in non-Western countries and a decent enough number of them that it should affect the content choices of the show. But as of the writings and the lesson plans for season three, I tend to focus on the Western and particularly Western European conception of things for very specific reasons, because that's where the whiteness was made. And a lot of what we do here is sort of tracing the whiteness that is ruining the planet now back to the whiteness that started ruining the planet 1,000 years ago. But that's kind of the thesis statement for a lot of the material that we cover. And as such, I cut out a lot of, well, this is the Chinese vampire lore, this is the African vampire lore. The Caribbeans actually have something called Loup Garou, which is like exactly the same as the La Loup Garou from France or whatever, which is the werewolf, and another evidence that werewolves and vampires and witches and shit are like intrinsically tied together. But the reality is vampires have been around for an extraordinarily goddamn long time. They haven't truly fallen out of fashion in like 900 years or some crazy shit like that. I'm very bad at the math, so I might be off on that. But from the emergence in like literature or you know, reports in court recordings and shit like that in like the 1600s to 2022 and shit like Twilight, like, There's really never been a break in vampire lore, the existence of vampires in folklore and urban legend. And as we're going to discuss later on in the episode, like, we were still digging up bodies to see if they were vampires in, like, the 1900s. In this country, in fact, after they were done doing it in Europe. So that's, we're two for two with that and witch hunts, I guess. But there's a lot, so I'm gonna wrap up the intro here and dive headfirst into a pool of vampirism. I don't know, that sounded weird, no? I probably could have worded that better. Fuck it. Here we go. Vampires. Let's do this. The first use of the word vampire in print in English occurred in 1688. And it appears vampire conceptually crystallized in the 15th century, although blood-sucking monsters, like I said before, exist in practically every culture on Earth. Well, okay, I say sucking. The truth is, vampires historically didn't suck blood at all. As we've discussed previously, the vampire of modern fiction is exactly that. Modern. The original vampire was much more like the ghoul from Arabian legend, and had a lot more to do with death and decomposition than, like, kinky sex and Kiefer Sutherland. Early accounts related to vampires often had to do with the exhumation of the dead and blood libel, but we'll get to that later. By 1718, Austria had record in the Treaty of Passerowitz of people digging up bodies to kill vampires, which were sort of like man-eating revenants, or in some conceptions, like a corpse inhabited by an evil spirit. Much like witches and werewolves, those suspected of vampirism were eventually tried and executed, both in Europe and the United States. Some believed committing suicide, being buried incorrectly, or being cursed could make one a vampire. The idea of transference by bite, though, didn't actually emerge until the 17th century, sort of with the explosion of Gothic vampire literature, which really redefined the myth. The modern vampire in folklore that most people are familiar with really originated in early 18th century southeastern Europe, and it was based on a confluence of several verbal traditions from surrounding areas. There are some commonalities in old folkloric accounts of vampires, though, such as a bloated appearance, which I think is interesting because it's the exact opposite of how they're portrayed now. Dark purplish skin, which is from gorging on blood, and they often slept with their left eyes open, wrapped in a burial shroud, and their teeth, their hair, and their nails would appear to have grown since death. So they had longer teeth, but the fangs thing didn't actually come along until a whole lot later. Oftentimes, people would report hearing chewing sounds coming from graves that they believed to be inhabited by vampires, and I can't think of anything more goddamn terrifying than walking through a graveyard in the middle of the night and thinking I'm hearing something chewing on something. Methods of prevention of vampires vary widely, from decapitation, which is pretty final, to elaborate vampire burial ceremonies. In the Italian Children's Necropolis, which is dated to the mid-5th century, archaeologists uncovered several graves that were believed to have been interred in such a way as to prevent vampirism. Now, we discussed the Lamia back in season 2 when we talked about mermaids. She was like a half-serpent woman from pre-Adamic biblical lore. She's based on a very similar story that some attribute as a prototypical vampire of sorts named Lilith. Lilith appears in Mesopotamian mythology as well as Hebrew, and she's often conceived of being the first wife of Adam. She's first referenced in 500 CE in Hebrew mythology, and she appears in the Babylonian Talmud as well as in the Book of Adam and Eve. She might be referenced in Isaiah 34:14, or they could be talking about an owl. It's actually kind of hard to say. She's a demon in Assyria, though, and Samaria and Babylon. Their religions, and in modern times, actually, she's come to symbolize sort of like feminism and a version of the sacred feminine in a lot of occult practice. The myth of Lilith has really developed a lot over time, particularly during the medieval period, when Lilith became not just Adam's first wife, but the story was kind of stretched out to suggest that she had been cast out of Eden for refusing to be subservient to Adam, and then whenever she was asked to return to the garden by a group of angels, she refused in favor of coupling with an archangel named Samael. Lilith translates roughly to night hag, or again, screech owl. And in much mythology, she stalks the night and steals children. Many later translations of the Bible remove references to her entirely, but she does appear in the Dead Sea Scrolls on a list of ancient monsters. And the Talmud describes women as, quote, growing long hair like Lilith, as one of the many curses of womanhood. Lilith is sort of semi-allegorical for sex and impurity in the Hebrew as well. An old Hebrew urban legend was that wet dreams and nighttime emissions created demons. And thus there's an old Hebrew adage that when a man sleeps alone in a house, he sleeps with Lilith. In some texts, she's called the first Eve. And in a nod to the Lamia, one old Jewish legend about Moses has him implore God to, quote, not be like Lilith who devours her own children, end quote. The story of Lilith as Adam's first wife actually dates to the 8th century. Around this time, newborn boys were given these amulets to wear until they were circumcised 8 days after they were born, and the amulet was supposed to protect them from Lilith. See, unlike Eve, Lilith was made from dust just like Adam, and as such, she viewed herself as his equal, naturally. Especially since she could apparently fly, which there doesn't seem to be any reference to Adam being able to do whatsoever. And, you know, it's reasonable, it stands to reason that we hadn't established patriarchy yet, there being only one man anywhere, apparently. So the two fought. A lot. And there's actually a reference in the Talmud that says, in effect, that Lilith peaced out on Eden after Adam refused to bottom for her, which I think is very interesting. And that is like the way it's worded. It doesn't specifically say anything about coitus. It's the two of them having an argument over who should be on the bottom during sex. And whenever Adam says, I will never bottom for you because I'm superior to you, Lilith flies away. So that's an interesting nod to something in old Hebrew legend that doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense on face value, but it does sound like, I say it doesn't make a lot of sense because it's always interesting to me whenever patriarchal religions that seem to have as a lot of, like, you know, when you look at not just how Lilith is portrayed, but how Eve is portrayed in a lot of these stories, not a very high opinion of women, still conceive of these, like, all-powerful women who will never listen to you no matter what you say. And it seems to me like, I don't know, bro, you've got the eraser. Like, you could just write the character differently. But, I don't know, maybe there's a reason you need a demonstration of how God punishes women who refuse to listen to men and instead choose to, like, grow their hair super long and fuck dudes named Sam. I'm not saying that that's in any way something that happened to whoever originally wrote this story, just that Sam was probably packing, that's all. Upon her refusal to return to the Garden of Eden, Lilith curses all children. The male children for 8 days, like I said, until circumcision, and then the female children got a menstrual cycle and a 20-day period after birth where they're at risk. And of course, no amulets. That's interesting that, you know, I mentioned this, I believe, on the mermaid episode, but it is something that whenever I look at women in folklore in particular, or female characters, I guess, it's fascinating how men writing these stories conceive of scenarios where women punish other women for being exceptional. You know what I mean? In a lot of stories, there's a situation where, like, a female god will grow jealous of a mortal woman and then punish her by turning her into a thing, or killing all of her children, or making her a thing that eats babies, or whatever. And it's just very interesting how time and time and time again throughout antiquity, there's all of these cases of men creating narratives where women punish other women for being too good at stuff. And I feel like that's probably reflective of something in society that perhaps we should examine because of how fucking frequently it seems to happen in literature. But it is something that I can't help but note, especially the cases of Lilith, where she is portrayed as a foil for Eve. Because in number one, a lot of the Hebrew conceptions of Eve don't just put it to you that she ate a piece of fruit offered to her by a snake. She fucked the snake because Adam wasn't giving it to her enough. That's the Hebrew conception of the Adam and Eve story in the garden. Eve goes and has sex with an animal because Adam isn't horny enough for her. And there is literally a section in this story where Adam complains to God that Eve has too much libido for him. So that's another thing that's apparently been going on since the beginning of recorded history. I need a woman who listens to me and just like wants to fuck all the time. Okay, we've got one of those. This one wants to fuck all the time. Why can't we just talk? Sometimes I want to go for a walk on the beach. Well, tell me about your feelings. But it's interesting to see how, number one, Eve is in this story sort of created as a replacement who will serve Adam, because Lilith has a mind of her own. And still in this story, it's very explicit that Adam is still very unhappy with Eve because, well, she's inferior to me. Yeah, that's what you said you wanted. And she wants to fuck all the time. Yeah, you said you wanted that too. And it's just very interesting on so many levels that, number one, men have apparently not changed since like the first one. And number two, the way these stories structure female interpersonal relationships in a way that it sort of engenders this natural idea of competitive behavior that may or may not have manifested itself socially for thousands and thousands of fucking years and was in fact engineered by men as a device to keep women from allowing each other to succeed. But that's really got nothing to do with vampires, or does it? Anyway, I'll get on with the script. Lilith sort of serves as an allegory for infant mortality rates during a time where infant death would have been really, really high. She's also closely identified with Asmodeus in demonology, and it's said that she births hundreds of demons every day. In addition to the precursor to some early conceptions of the vampire, Lilith was also probably a major influence on the medieval idea of the succubus, as she's usually associated with lust when she's not strangling and eating babies. Lilith and Eve really tell us a lot about ancient views on women and gender. Lilith is cast out for refusing to serve, but like I said, Adam's not satisfied with the woman who he has made specifically to be subservient either. Lilith eventually goes on to become the Lamia in Greco-Roman mythology, where her first ties to vampires are introduced. Augustine Calmet, a Benedictine monk, wrote that she had a connection to vampirism and to sorcery, saying, quote, "Some learned men have thought they discovered some vestiges of vampirism in the remotest antiquity. But all that they say of it does not come near what is related of the vampires, the Lamia, the Strigae, the sorcerers whom they accused of sucking the blood of living people, and of thus causing their death, the magicians who were said to cause the death of newborn children by charms and malignant spells are nothing less than what we have understand by the name of vampires. Even were it to be owned that these Lamia and Strigae have really existed, which we do not believe can ever be well proved, I own that these terms, Lamia and Strigae, are found in the verses of Holy Scripture. For instance, Isaiah, describing the condition to which Babylon was to be reduced after her ruin, says that she shall become the abode of satyrs, Lamia and Strigae, Lilith in Hebrew. This last term, according to the Hebrews, signifies the same thing as the Greeks express by Strix and Lamia, which are sorceresses or magicians who seek to put to death newborn children, whence it comes that the Jews are accustomed to write in the four corners of the chamber of a woman, a woman just delivered, quote, Adam, Eve, begone from hence Lilith. End quote. The ancient Greeks knew these dangerous sorceresses by the names of Lamia, and they believed that they devoured children or sucked away all the blood till they died. End quote. The Strigae that are mentioned there probably refers to the Strigoi, a Romani vampire myth about a creature that's able to transform into animals and also render itself invisible and gain life force by drinking blood. Sound familiar? The Strigoi were a large influence on Bram Stoker's Dracula in particular. They're also linked to the first historical account of a person being accused of vampirism in the mid-1650s. A man named Jure Grando Alilovic, sorry, the double L's fuck me up sometimes, Alilovic of Istria is said to have terrorized the local villagers of his hometown 16 years after he died. Eventually, his corpse was decapitated by the local priest. The tale of this was documented in a book called The Glory of the Duchy of Carniola, which was written by scientist Johann Vicard von Valvasor. And that is considered the first written document on vampires. The Striga are also of Transylvanian legend, but here, they're more like witches than vampires. You'll note that he used the word Strix there. In our episode on the Malleus Maleficarum, we discussed that Strixology was established in the medieval period as a study of witchcraft. The Striga is discussed further in 1865 in regards to Transylvanian folklore by Wilhelm Schmidt. They're discussed there as a nocturnal creature that eats children. And as recently as 1909, the Striga has been mentioned in the Carpathian Mountains as connected to missing children. Ways one could become a Striga included being the seventh child of the same gender in a family, I guess just bad luck, or also dying without getting married, or also by suicide again, or a curse from a witch. So really, I guess you only kind of have control over one of those things. Besides the folklore and legend about night demons and bloodsuckers, some vampire fear really comes down to a few rather practical explanations. The first we've referenced on previous episodes, and that's that people used to be a lot worse at knowing when someone was dead. Like, really bad. Deplorably fucking bad. So bad, we needed, like, special coffins, called safety coffins. Basically, if you were accidentally buried alive, these coffins were designed so that you wouldn't die in your coffin. Some of them had bells, some of them had breathing tubes, there's legit descriptions of safety coffins that had fireworks hooked up to them, because, I don't know, I guess nothing gets the attention of the night watchman like a coffin on fire underground. There were many, many designs, though, and there was basically an entire cottage industry based around preventing premature burial. Fear of being mistaken for dead really peaked during the cholera epidemics of the 1800s, and Edgar Allan Poe wrote about it in several stories, such as The Fall of the House of Usher and the aptly titled The Premature Burial, in which there's supposedly actual accounts from people of premature burials. Safety coffins rose to prominence as a sort of, like I said, cottage industry made to combat a very real fear of being buried alive. Some coffins with glass lids on them were in fashion for a time, so as to make it easier to see if occupants were still breathing. I'm sure after a certain point that got gnarly. The first safety coffin was made in 1792 for Duke Ferdinand of Brunswick, who had a coffin constructed with windows to let the sun in, an air tube, a lock on the inside, the keys to which were put in Ferdinand's pocket, and, according to some accounts, fireworks. So the tube that I mentioned, the air tube, actually served a dual purpose. If you were alive, you'd be able to breathe, and also, every day a priest would come by and sniff the tube to monitor your rate of decomposition. And you wonder why so many of them got the plague. It's also worth mentioning that that's something else that they didn't really understand particularly well. In addition to safety coffins, the Germans designed portable death chambers, an apparatus with the bell that I mentioned earlier. Some of them even had feeding tubes so that food could be dropped into the coffin just in case. I just imagine the fucking smell, oh my god. Exhumed coffins that had bodies in them with torn clothes and bloody hands and torn fingernails from trying to claw out after someone realized that they'd been buried alive may have contributed to belief that the dead were coming back to life. Speaking of smells, I mentioned decomposition a second ago, and a lack of understanding of decomposition and how decomposition works, which probably contributed to vampire legends as well. In the book, Vampires, Burial, and Death, Paul Barber posits that a belief in vampires came from people in pre-industrial societies attempting to explain the process of decomposition. Vampirism was often attributed to corpses looking unnatural, having longer hair, longer teeth, longer fingernails, and also being flush with blood. This is because people weren't yet aware that the scalp, gums, and nail beds recede after death, giving the illusion of continued growth. Gases accumulate inside corpses, which also gives them the look that they had been gorged recently, or had eaten a lot. In some cases, people exhumed looked fuller than they had in life, leading to conclusions that the corpses had been feeding. It's noteworthy that grave robbing was also fairly prominent at the time, which probably also contributed to reports of moved and disheveled-looking corpses. Another influence on the vampire myth, fairly apparent, I think, is the anti-Jewish canard of blood libel. Yeah, again. During the rise of Christianity, perception of Judaism as a sort of pagan religion became a lot more prevalent, And as, for example, the increase in Russian pogroms drove more of the Jewish population from Russia into Western Europe, it's worth mentioning that Jewish sanitary practices such as not handling the dead or other people's bodily fluids ensured that when the plague struck Europe, less Jewish people were affected, which gave rise to suspicion among Christians that Jews were somehow responsible for the plague, which really only increased the persecution that the Jewish people were already dealing with. Christians in the Middle Ages believed Jesus cursed the Jews from the cross to have ulcers and internal hemorrhages that would require them to consume blood constantly. And Jewish people were frequently linked to diseases like leprosy and porphyria, which is a disease typically associated with vampirism, actually. It's a liver disorder that can turn the urine purple, giving the untrained eye the impression that one is pissing blood, probably what led to Christian accusations that Jewish men menstruated out of their penises. And just to drive the whole point home, I think Hitler himself compared the Jewish people to vampires in Mein Kampf, drawing on what was an acceptable correlation at the time, in part due to the success of the film Nosferatu. Nosferatu was sort of like an unofficial film adaptation of Dracula, and interestingly enough, I didn't know this, the reason we don't have a complete version of the film is because Bram Stoker's wife hit them with like a breach of copyright and had all of the original printings of the film destroyed. So I guess even though they've been able to mostly restore it from negatives and stuff at this point, there's no real finished original version of the film because Bram Stoker's wife said she wanted all of them burned because she didn't get paid for it. Which, you know, mixed feelings. In many ways, Nosferatu really doubled down on the anti-Semitic depictions of the vampire, something that was actually noted at the premiere of the film by Julius Streicher, who you may recognize the name of. He was the chief editor of the Nazi publication Der Stürmer, who you may recognize from the episode that we did covering Blood Libel, was a publication that ran so hard with the idea that Hitler was embarrassed by it. Nosferatu also plays up another trope that's common to both vampires and anti-Semitic stereotypes alike, and that's the proximity to plague vectors like rats, spiders, and bats, which signifies a link between Jews and the plague. Many of these ideas were gathered together under one umbrella in Dracula, which played a huge part in catapulting vampire stories into the zeitgeist, but there's still a little framework necessary before we tackle that. Before Dracula really completely changed the game, there were a few vampire stories that paved the way for Stoker's coming out party. The first were part of the 19th century penny dreadful trend. Penny dreadfuls were sort of like a precursor to Pulp Fiction, and they've been referred to as the video games of the Victorian era. They were weekly 8 to 16 page stories that cost a penny. Penny dreadfuls first appeared in 1830, and they introduced the world to characters like the demon barber, Sweeney Todd, and Varney the Vampire. Varney the Vampire ran from 1845 to 1847, and in book form, the serial ran to 876 double-column pages with 232 chapters, a sort of, like, early gothic horror book that established many of the tropes that would later be used in Stoker's Dracula. Varney tells the story of Sir Francis Varney, a vampire who harasses a disgraced, formerly wealthy family called the Bannerworths. The story sort of can't decide if Varney is a vampire or just thinks he's a vampire, but it's one of the first examples of a vampire turning humans into vampires. Varney is portrayed as a sympathetic character who loathes his vampiric state, seen as a burden of bloodlust, which is another popular aspect of vampire characterization that's established here. Varney was also the first vampire with fangs, leaving a set of puncture marks on his victims' necks. He also hypnotizes his victims, something that's seen on display multiple times later in Dracula. Unlike later depictions of vampires, Varney isn't nocturnal, and the Jewish-coded fear of Christian iconography, like crucifixes, you always wondered where that came from, didn't you, is not yet part of the character profile. They actually pay tribute to Varney as the prototypical vampire in Marvel Comics. In Marvel lore, the first vampire ever was created by the Atlanteans, and is named Varney in homage to the progenitor of the archetype. In 1872, Sheridan Le Fanu released Carmilla, which was a lesbian vampire novella, which was first published as a serial that really introduced another common modern vampire trope, queer coding. Vampires and their representation of bloodborne illness and taboo opposition to religious sociological norms are often used as an analogy for fears about queerness. Some go so far as to suggest that the penetrative nature of a vampire attack serves as an analogy for both gay sex and AIDS. To be fair, Dracula was partially conceived to represent fears about syphilis, which was rampant in Europe at the time. Carmilla was a powerful woman who only hunted other women. Men were fairly powerless against her, so her piece as a genesis point for vampire stories of female empowerment and the trope of the sapphic vampire are both clear. As a vampire, Carmilla can transform into a cat, and she also only hunts at night and sleeps in a coffin the first time that's introduced. She also bears a striking resemblance to Lucy, who would appear in Stoker's Dracula 26 years later. Carmilla, the novel, also introduced the proto-Van Helsing intrepid vampire hunter character of Baron Vordenburg. There's some aspects of Carmilla that are inspired, albeit loosely, on a historical proto-vampire, the Countess Elizabeth Bathory, a Hungarian noblewoman from the 17th century. Bathory believed that, allegedly, anyway, believed that bathing in the blood of young girls would keep her young. And she's believed to have killed at least 80 young women between 1590 and 1610 when she was bricked inside her living quarters until she died. Some historians now doubt the veracity of some of these claims, and they believe that Bathory may have been the victim of a political framing used to destroy Bathory's family on behalf of the Habsburg Empire. This is disputed heavily, so we're not sure how much of the Blood Countess story is real and how much is fiction, but the story certainly fed into vampire stories when they began becoming more prevalent in the later 1600s. The Gothic vampire romance sort of initiated as a genre in 1819 with the release of John William Polidori's Vampire, which is a novel produced from the same Byronic literary contest that produced Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and it's considered to be the first successful vampire romance fusion novel, truly setting the tone for Carmilla and then Bram Stoker's Dracula. Dracula was published in 1897, and it tells the story of Count Dracula, a Transylvanian nobleman who is secretly a vampire. Stoker's vampire really grasps at numerous folklore regarding werewolves, the previous works, like I said, of Carmilla and Varney the Vampire, and the historical real Count Dracula, Vlad Tepes. Vlad III, a.k.a. Vlad the Impaler, a.k.a. Vlad Dracul, was a Romanian national hero and a voivod of Wallachia. A voivod was basically a warlord, for all intents and purposes. Vlad Dracul III was a military hero during the time of the Ottoman Empire. He was held captive from 1463 until 1475, and it's during this period in captivity when the legends portraying him as a cruel and vicious monster really began to circulate, starting in Germany and then later moving over into Austria and Transylvania. Books describing the acts of Vlad the Impaler actually constitute the first German bestsellers since the advent of the printing press. Stories of his violence spread into Russia, and Romanians merely accepted the propaganda as fact. The first stories about Vlad made their way to Pope Pius II, who then reprinted them in his commentaries. The initial stories were that Vlad had impaled two monks and their donkey to assist their entrance into heaven. It's probably made up, but it's still clever. Those were circulated and they were turned into a stage play called Story of a Despot Called Dracula, Voivod of Wallachia, in 1463. The stories about Vlad's cruelty were meant to justify his imprisonment by his enemies, and they continued throughout his 12-year captivity. But these stories that were intended to demonize Vlad to some turned him into something of a folk hero to others. Tales of his capturing enemies from Turkey and forcing them to eat one another, for example, and also a story about a garden of gigantic steaks that Vlad would allegedly sit in and drink tea while he listened to his victims scream. Intended to cast Vlad as a barbarian, they actually made him a figure amongst the Romanian people, synonymous with swift and vicious justice against the enemies of the country. And of course, the fact that none of this shit actually happened was something of an afterthought. Stories of Vlad's plunder of Transylvania became legendary over time, and the movable type printing press ensured most of Europe knew about Wallachia's bloodthirsty warlord. Stories comparing Vlad to Nero and Caligula, a bloodthirsty but noble maniac who committed what amounts to genocide, are completely unverifiable and believed to be nothing more than war propaganda at this point. Vlad's connection to vampirism comes from Stoker's novel, which took its name from the legend of Vlad the Impaler. An article discussing vampire lore in Transylvania that was published in 1885, recounting the story of Vlad the Impaler, interested Stoker, who filled in the gaps in his limited knowledge about Vlad with details about Attila the Hun. And he drew further on the legend of Vlad from William Wilkinson's account of the principalities of Wallachia and Moldavia with political observations relative to them, a work published in 1820 that discussed German legends about Vlad as though they were factual. Stoker's vampire was originally named Count Wampir, and he changed the name and input various historical pieces from Wilkinson in the novel. Stoker took extensive notes on various folklore, Bathory and Vlad, and many anti-Jewish tropes, some old, some newer, like Svengali. Published in 1894, just 3 years before Dracula, Trilby by George Du Maurier, introduced the character of Svengali, who was an Ashkenazi Jew stereotype who seduces, manipulates, dominates, and exploits Trilby, the eponymous character who is an Irish girl who becomes a famous singer. In the novel, Svengali is described as having beady black Jew's eyes, and is also described as having teeth like a dog and a beak like a crow. The character is also described as filthy, effeminate, physically repugnant, and evil, and he hypnotizes Trilby into becoming a talented singer. Dracula similarly hypnotizes women and holds a preternatural sway over the will of others. Many of Stoker's characterizations would become archetypal in literature since then. His conception of the vampire served very much so to establish the vampire as a sex symbol, something that's been synonymous with vampires ever since. The novel was actually started the month after Stoker's friend, Oscar Wilde, was imprisoned for homosexuality, and there's some speculation that Stoker was also gay, and his vampire's sexually ambiguous nature and threat of penetration was meant to address society's fears about queerness. The gender roles in the novel are also fairly inverted throughout much of the story. One of the protagonists, Jonathan Harker, is raped by three women. Dracula is not portrayed as masculine so much as visceral. The first film adaptation of Dracula, which we discussed earlier, was Nosferatu, and it really eschewed a lot of the sexy in favor of the gross and anti-Semitic. And it played up many of the character traits that were associated with that particular aspect of vampire lore. Dracula is also the origin of the vampire's association with bats. In a nod to Varney and Carmilla's shape-shifting abilities, Dracula transforms into a bat. Many people believe that this association went the other way around, but vampire bats are actually named after vampires. Dracula effectively pushed the vampire into the spotlight of horror literature for centuries, and that's kind of the origin point for the archetypal vampire that we had until, I guess, Twilight, really. So that's generally speaking European folklore, but what about the real world? Well, vampires appeared here for the first time in Serbia, in 1725. Townspeople in Kisiljevo said a man named Peter Blagojevic had risen from the dead and had subsequently murdered 9 villagers. People began to fall ill, claiming that Peter came to them in their sleep and tried to suffocate them. Eventually, Blagojevich was exhumed by a local priest, and it was determined that he looked younger and his hair, teeth, and nails had grown. Convinced that he was a vampire, the people of Kisiljevo staked the corpse through the heart and burned the body. A second case then occurred in 1732, once again in Serbia. 13 villagers died in very short fashion, leading to a military investigation that again exhumed bodies and found them looking youthful and full. These were then decapitated and likewise burned. This incident made national newspapers in all the way over in Austria, where it reached the king, Friedrich Wilhelm I of Prussia, who needed reassured by his medical advisors and scholars that vampires weren't real. Unfortunately, nobody told the villagers, and people weren't really aware that tuberculosis was a thing yet. The idea of a body maintaining its youth and lacking signs of decomposition was previously ascribed to saints by the church, and this idea of vampirism challenged that. The church's conquests of Romania, Bosnia, and Serbia introduced new cultures and superstitions to the broader Holy Roman Empire, and by 1730, there was a huge panic going on about vampires that the church wasn't really equipped to address yet. The Serbian panic over vampires forced the queen, Maria Theresa, to launch a formal investigation into the stories of vampirism. Her court physician, Gerhard van Swieten, found the stories were founded in a lack of understanding of things like tuberculosis, fermentation, and lack of oxygen in corpses. His findings were then published in 1755, determining that vampires did not exist. After this was found scientifically, Maria Theresa made the exhumation and maiming of corpses illegal, and instead decreed that all vampire reports were to be made to authorities to be investigated as pranks. Now, it's interesting to note that when Maria Theresa made that declaration, she was pregnant with Marie Antoinette, who would later be beheaded, not for being a vampire, just for being an awful bitch. Despite findings to the contrary, nearly 40 years prior to this, New England also mistook tuberculosis for vampirism in the 1790s and the 1800s. Tuberculosis, aka consumption, was actually called consumption due to a belief that the dead consumed the life from the living. The cause was unknown until the late 19th century, when it was discovered to be bacterial in origin. And because it's highly contagious, whole households would quickly fall ill and die, reinforcing this belief that dead relatives would drain the life force from the living. And then, of course, when the dead were exhumed, the bodies looked fresh, as they were described in accounts, and still full of life. And theories on how to deal with this ranged from just flipping the body over to cutting out the organs and burning them. The body sans innards would then be reburied, sometimes decapitated. It was also believed that inhaling the smoke and ash from burning vampires could cure consumption, and we wonder why people died so often. Maybe the most famous case of the New England vampire panic would have been that of Mercy Brown from Rhode Island. This is considered one of the best documented cases of the exhumation of a corpse to perform rituals to banish the undead. Mercy died on January 17th, 1892, at the age of 19. Her mother died first, and then her older sister, Mary Olive. After this, Mercy and her brother Edwin both contracted tuberculosis as well. At this point, neighbors began whispering about vampirism. After Mercy died, her father George had several of the family's bodies exhumed. The mother, Mary Eliza, and the daughter Olive were deemed appropriately decomposed, but Mercy, they said, still looked alive. Now, incidentally, Mercy had been buried in an above-ground crypt at, like, freezer-like conditions, and her decomposition was slowed down. But the townspeople saw a vampire, so Mercy's heart and liver were cut out, burned, and the ashes were mixed into a tonic and given to her sick brother Edwin to drink as a presumed cure for consumption. He died 2 months later, and Mercy's desecrated remains were reburied in a cemetery. H.P. Lovecraft's story The Shunned House is actually based on Mercy Brown. She was the last recorded case of vampirism, having died in 1892, but cases occurred all over New England for 99 years, and we were digging up vampires in New England almost to the beginning of the 20th century. It gets weirder, though. Were you aware that Mormons believe in vampires? Apparently, the LDS had a profound influence on Twilight. Author Stephanie Meyer is a Mormon, and she had visions that informed the story. References to typical Mormon beliefs are actually peppered throughout the text, and the Mormon belief in divine ascension is represented by the Cullen family, who are described variously in the series as godlike and inhumanly beautiful. Mormons actually believe angels are resurrected humans, and it's speculated that Meyer's vampires are based on the Mormon angel myth. This would be why her vampires sparkle. While there's some pretty heavy-handed imagery in the film, depicting Edward as looking like he has wings, Mormon angels don't actually have those. There's also the indigenous werewolf character Jacob, who imprints on Bella's child, which is a reference to Mormons' almost British Israelite belief that they share a common ancestry with Native Americans. The Mormons believe in a fake group of people called the Lamanites, who were dark-skinned Native Americans, and it's noteworthy that the Native character in the film's last name is Black, and all the Wolf tribes' names are Hebrew, such as Ephraim, Levi, Seth, Paul. I think you get the idea. It's probably a bit too on the nose to not be on purpose, I think. And it's also sort of interesting because the Mormon demonization campaigns of like the 1700s and 1800s, like so many other demonization campaigns, compared Mormons to vampires. And in fact, a lot of people who've left the church have compared Mormons to vampires as a hypnotic group of people who manipulate and exploit women. And that's sort of an interesting thing in and of itself, because that is sort of the characterization of vampires that is used pejoratively against lots of groups of people, whether we're talking about Roma, the Jews, women. There's a lot of different groups of queer people who are variously associated with the negative connotations that come from vampirism. And that seems to be evident of its historical ties to blood libel, in that it's more of an accusation than a thing as it manifests itself socially, and I find that kind of interesting. Or at least that was how it worked until New Age, like every other goddamn thing, and you had real vampires, a thing that you can see in places like New Orleans nowadays. Real vampires, be they people who drink blood or something considerably lamer, called an energy vampire. Or a psychic vampire, I think, is the other way that it's referred to. And these people believe that they thrive off of draining the life force energy from other people. So they're vampires, but like blood is icky. And then there are, in fact, people who engage in various forms of blood drinking and bloodletting as kind of an either psychosexual or lifestyle proto-gothic vampire thing, the vampire lifestyle. It's kind of tied to the occult, but not entirely. There are magical aspects to it, but not always. And it's one of many ways that vampirism has been so prevalent in culture everywhere that there are, just like there are people who think there are druids, and people who think they worship the devil, and people who think they're witches, there are people who believe that they're vampires based on a misconception of magic ritual and an edgelordy desire to drink blood. And, you know, more power to you. I think it's cringe, but, you know, what do I know? I'm an old person. So that's generally speaking, vampires. I mean, there's, again, you could talk about the Chupacabra as an example of a vampire folkloric legend that's about an animal. There's vampire creatures in Africa that are very interesting. There's vampires from Vietnam who fly by sticking their toes in their ears and flap. They stick their toes in their nostrils and then they flap their ears, and they hide amongst regular people during the day, and then at night they stick their toes in their nostrils, fly in people's windows, and drain their life force energy or eat dead bodies. And then they clean themselves off when they get home and no one's the wiser, which is a very elaborate vampire myth, if I do say so myself. But again, it's just one of those things that's, for whatever reason, and I think it's probably got something to do with fear of death. I think anytime you're talking about immortality, you're talking about people who are afraid of ending. And also a fascination with blood is what gives life, especially in a time period where we knew fuck all about medicine, evidenced by the fact that they were burying people alive left and right. And sort of a fear of the other, because in so many cases the vampire is a vehicle for xenophobia and blood libel and a fear of the other, or you know, queer people, women, Jews, whatever group we happen to be discussing, people with diseases, like we talked about a bit ever so briefly, that in a lot of modern conceptions, particularly with Bram Stoker, vampires are sort of an allegory for sexually transmitted diseases and bloodborne illnesses as things that people were afraid of, didn't understand, but knew that sometimes unwanted human contact had something to do with that. And also plague vectors in the representation of rats, bats, things that typically have rabies. The plague in particular was, of course, tied to fleas and rats, and that murdered how many people? We don't actually know. So there's a lot of things that I think you could say it's fair are messages that are trying to be gotten across when you talk about vampires. And of course, that whatever it is about them strikes a chord in people, or we wouldn't have examples of vampirism going back until the beginning of recorded history. I mean, it's interesting, and in a way it's good that we're using vampires as a wrap up to spooky season, because all of these other, you know, characters and monsters and cryptids and creatures, you can kind of look to an origin point and say, oh, that's whenever the church made that thing up as this. And while we can say, here's where vampires became associated with these things, the idea's been around as long as we have, which, again, I think suggests that we've been afraid of dying and curious about what makes us alive versus what makes us not. Because I think there's something in vampire stories as well about the question of what makes one alive. Because here is a thing with no pulse, with no soul, if that's a thing you believe in, that is up and moving around and thinking sentiently and making decisions and being interactive. So what makes you alive if death doesn't end being alive? If that's not how you determine what separates here from not here, how do you do that? And I think vampires allow you to have sort of a conversation with yourself about what being alive really means. What is the concept of eternity? Does life matter if it never ends? Could you get bored with something like that? I think it would take me all of a week. But I think that these, if I can serve this as like a wrap up to the whole of spooky season, I think that a lot of this stuff allows people to question things that You know, frighten you sounds reductive, but the unknown, things that you can't immediately dismiss with answers, you know, such as why are all of the children going missing? Why do some people spontaneously start dancing and then they can't stop? Why are some people writhing around on the ground possessed by demons and other people are writhing around on the ground possessed by gods? What's going on? And in that way, I think that the folklore of the horror tropes, the monsters and myths and legends, is in many ways proto-conspiracy theory, because what is it other than a group of people who've decided that there's something out there that doesn't want you to know that it's out there, that's independently thinking and acting and perhaps fucking up all of the crops? And, you know, that's not a super far leap from spending way, way, way too much time going over the Zapruder film. So I guess we did it. We figured out a way to make Spooky Season make sense in some way, and that's fucking vampires, listeners. That's my hour long crash course in everything that I could shake a stick at involved in the European conception of blood sucking monsters. So I hope you enjoyed that, and I hope you enjoyed Spooky Season. That's been, it was fun. I liked the idea of taking a month around Halloween to explore some not explicitly political material, and I'm just as excited to get back into explicitly political material. But, in the meantime, we'll be back. Same Mox time, same Mox channel. Like I said, we're going to take a week off here, but when we do come back, get yourselves ready, listeners, because I think, without looking at my schedule at all, so this could be entirely wrong, so maybe don't get excited, because maybe this isn't what's happening. Or am I, in fact, marrying myself to doing whatever I'm about to say right now? We'll find out later. I think when we come back, we are covering David Duke on Monday, the John Birch Society on Wednesday, and either the Soldier of Fortune magazine or Libertarian Sea Colonies, I think that Friday is what we've got for lesson plans when we come back. So after Jesus Christ, probably close to 60 or 70 episodes of the show now, we're finally going to talk about David Duke and the Modern Clan. I've been putting it off because I wanted to do all of it at once with the Clan, so it's going to be a fairly in-depth look at the KKK when we come back, and particularly how David Duke figures into the history and rebranding of the Modern Ku Klux Klan. So that's what we're going to be doing when we come back. But in the meantime, concentrate on the HEP, everybody. I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See. And I will catch all of you beautiful people on the flip side. Smooches. Deuces, dig it.
Finished.